Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Water for All, Global Solutions for a Changing Climate, by David Sedlak, narrated by Gary Tiedemann. Preface. When it comes to water, it would be easy to be a pessimist, because wherever we look, catastrophe looms. Droughts have emptied reservoirs, damaged crops, and caused wells to run dry. Hundreds of millions of women and children in rural villages spend several hours every day hauling water. Even in places where tap water freely flows, millions fear that drinking it will make them sick. Elsewhere, ecosystems deprived of water or overcome by pollution from farms, industry, and cities teeter on the edge of collapse. None of this is new. Water crises have been nearly a constant feature of human history. Civilization has been shaped by the need to secure water to grow food, power industry, and meet the demands of growing cities. As population density increases and communities accrue wealth, water supplies gradually expand through incremental investments. But the approach used to manage water eventually runs up against physical limitations. When this happens, a period of crisis often ensues as the institutions responsible for water management encounter reluctance from community members about the need to allocate more resources to solve the problem. For growing cities, this hesitancy might result in an unwillingness to raise money to transition from local groundwater wells to imported water supplies, or to make investments in water and wastewater treatment plants needed to protect human health and the environment. Similarly, agrarian communities might resist the need to invest in reservoirs or precision irrigation systems as long-term droughts cut into crop yields. Local economic conditions, geography, and politics make every water crisis different. As a result, there is no single solution. After an initial period of hesitation, the wealthy often respond to water crises with massive infrastructure projects, while communities at the other end of the income spectrum are usually forced to adjust their expectations about growth. Communities adjacent to mountains tend to build dams and use gravity to deliver water, while those living on land underlain by permeable rock formations drill groundwater wells. Strong central governments create top-down national water plans, while nations committed to the free market often leave it to individuals and local communities to solve their water crises independently. Under normal circumstances, the process of water system expansion that has arisen over the centuries would continue much as it has for centuries. But these are not ordinary times. Humanity is entering a period when rapid growth is colliding with the Earth's capacity to accommodate societal needs. A changing climate, coupled with close to 8 billion people striving for ever-increasing living standards, means that many of the institutions and approaches being used to manage water are no longer viable. It is not your imagination. Water crises are arriving at a greater frequency, and the 20th century approach cannot keep up. This book provides an overview of the clever ways that people solve water crises. Some of the solutions involve big infrastructure, such as dams, canals, groundwater wells, and desalination plants. Others rely upon large numbers of smaller devices, such as drip irrigation tubing that delivers water directly to the roots of a plant, or washing machines that need a fraction of the water used by their predecessors. And some solutions require no new equipment. Many water crises can be solved through better policies and laws. Understanding the limitations of each of these approaches and the ways that they can be used in concert will be critical to making the right decisions about how to respond to water crises in the coming decades. There is no simple formula for solving water crises, but seeing the connections among seemingly disparate problems is a powerful means of bringing about change. Because our minds crave organization, I have divided the world's water challenges into six distinct crises. This shorthand notation provides a convenient means of sorting out responses that are likely to make sense in communities with different economic conditions, geography, and politics. It also lines up with the institutions that are normally responsible for planning, financing, and operating water systems. The decision to depict water problems as crises is also a simplification. By emphasizing the critical period when change comes about as existing approaches fail to meet pressing needs, it is possible to gain insight into the attributes of successful solutions. But for every place that faces a water crisis, it is possible to find communities that managed to bring about change without reaching a point that can be characterized as a crisis. These cases are worthy of examination, but they tend to lack the drama needed to maintain the listener's attention. After all, this is not a textbook. To provide insights into the underlying causes and possible solutions to the six water crises, I have chosen representative examples from around the world. In some cases, I have focused on problems taking place in my backyard, or in places where I have been lucky enough to gain firsthand knowledge. Because my personal experience is limited, I have turned to primary sources and the reporting of others for examples from places where I do not have direct experience. I recognize that telling the stories about unfamiliar places is fraught with peril. With enough patience, an author might be able to gather the salient facts and figures, but it is too easy to filter information through preconceived notions of the way that the world works. I have done my best to present all my examples of water crises through the perspectives of those who are experiencing them, with an emphasis on the people who end up making the decisions about how they should be resolved. Thus, I have attempted to depict that world as it is, and not how I wish it would be. I do not intend to preclude the possibility that perseverant people who are currently shut out of the decision-making process can bring about change. But anyone who aspires to be a changemaker needs to understand the status quo that they hope to disrupt. Vignettes about water crises are a form of storytelling, a way of communicating that tends to oversimplify complex events by creating a linear narrative populated by heroes and villains. This approach may hold a listener's attention, but it is often inconsistent with reality. People who pursue careers in water usually do so because they have a sincere desire to solve problems. I have yet to meet someone who set out to be a polluter, or to create an impenetrable bureaucracy that prevents their fellow citizens from accessing water. Rather, each actor has a different set of priorities that often results in unintended consequences that exacerbate water crises and create barriers to their solution. For the sake of the narrative, stories often give the listener a false impression that to those who were involved, the solutions were always evident and that there was no other way to succeed. In practice, water crises are harder to understand as they transpire because they tend to play out over multiple decades. In addition, many of the key facts are uncertain when the decisions are made. Successful solutions may have required years of experimentation in which the benefits that a revolutionary idea delivered were too small or the risks that accompanied them were too great to justify their adoption. In many cases, ideas that seem attractive today might turn out to be dead ends, while others that have lost their popularity will succeed in a different form in another decade or two. Despite these limitations, I believe that the successes, failures, and speculative ideas that fill this book might temper the pessimism that you feel about the world's water crises. I hope that they will encourage you to become part of the change that must come about in the coming years. Optimism is a powerful tool, but the magnitude of the water challenges the world faces should not be underestimated. It is going to take hard work to avoid crises that are more severe than those we are already experiencing. Just as we should not underestimate our current challenges, so we should not misjudge the capacity of people to rise to the occasion. I wrote this book because I believe that with sufficient imagination, we have the capacity to solve any water crisis. Working together, I am certain that we can realize water for all. The Six Water Crises. Through water, our humanity is revealed. As will become evident, it is easier to develop new solutions to water crises if they are thought of as fitting into six distinct categories. 1. Water for the wealthy. 2. For the many. 3. For the unconnected. 4. For good health. 5. For food. And 6. For ecosystems. As opposed to the habit of journalists, pundits, and politicians to lump a diverse set of problems under the banner of the global water crisis, a more careful differentiation among the water problems faced by society provides greater insight into the reasons why current ways of solving crises are only partially effective and avoids the erroneous assumption that one-size-fits-all solutions exist. To solve the world's water problems, we must recognize that no two water crises are alike. They differ with respect to their underlying causes, how they manifest themselves, and the resources available for fighting them. The six water crises are defined by the economic status of the people who need water, how the water is used, and the nature of the problems caused by an inability to manage it properly. Although such a classification scheme may prove helpful, it is worth recognizing that the situation is more complicated because multiple types of water crises often occur simultaneously. Within each category of water crisis, factors such as climate, geology, geography, and cultural attitudes affect the magnitude of the problem and the likelihood that a specific response will succeed. In fact, the distinctly local nature of humankind's relationship with water is one of the greatest challenges associated with efforts to apply solutions that have worked for one crisis to a new situation. Chapter 1. Water for Household Use. Everyone needs water, but the amount of water that we use in our homes, the ways that we obtain it, and the institutions responsible for managing it vary considerably. When water scarcity arises, these differences determine how communities respond. As a result of the overriding effect of wealth on the available solutions, it is helpful to distinguish among three separate crises of household water use that face communities in different economic situations. The first crisis is often the easiest to solve: water shortages affecting wealthy people who live in cities. This is not to imply that the threats faced by the world's affluent city dwellers are trivial. Rather, people who live in cities on the upper end of the income spectrum already have the means of overcoming almost any water crisis they are likely to encounter. In addition to being tractable, the consequences of rich people's water crises are often modest relative to those experienced by people with lower incomes. What passes for a water crisis in a wealthy city might be considered only a minor inconvenience for many of the world's less affluent water users. Nonetheless, people who live in well-off cities have no need ever to experience even a mild water shortage if they recognize the best time to respond to a drought is about a decade before it occurs. Wealthy city dwellers also merit our attention because they play a crucial role in advancing new solutions to water crises. Their investments in technologies that have not yet been perfected drive down costs and increase accessibility for the rest of the world's water users. The water supply challenges recently faced by Santa Barbara, California, exemplify the first category of water crises. You could be forgiven if you have never heard of this picturesque coastal city, wedged between steep mountains and the Pacific Ocean, just north of Los Angeles. The movie stars who call Santa Barbara home probably prefer a little anonymity. With a median household income of over $65,000 per year, The 100,000 or so people who call Santa Barbara home would seem like the last people who would face any kind of crisis. However, the steep hills that separate the city from the valley to the east initially prevented Santa Barbara from accessing the aqueduct that has protected over 22 million residents of Southern California from drought since the 1960s. For Santa Barbara, a water supply system consisting of a few reservoirs in the coastal hills, supplemented by groundwater wells near the city, allowed it to develop from a Spanish mission into a thriving city. Santa Barbara's reliance on a local supply finally led to a water crisis in the late 1980s, after a 6-year period when about half of the normal amount of rain fell. Because the city had few other options to compensate for its water shortage, it built a seawater desalination plant. Given the state of the art for desalination at that time, the water that the plant produced was almost 8 times more expensive than the city's existing supply. Paying for a desalination plant was not necessarily popular with the local citizens, but it was the best available option at the height of the drought. As often seems to be the case when a city invests in an expensive new water supply project, the drought ended a few months after the desalination plant was completed in 1991. 2 years later, Santa Barbara's other response to its water shortage, which the city had initiated in parallel with the decision to pursue desalination, succeeded when a new branch of the state's imported water system was extended to a reservoir that served the city. After a few years, the desalination plant was decommissioned. The return of wet conditions and the connection of the city to California's imported water system may have ended the water crisis of 1991, but it did not resolve the underlying problem. Santa Barbara's latecomer status to the state's complicated water rights system meant that its imported water allocation was not guaranteed during future dry periods when the city would most need it. Of course, the operators of the state-run water supply canal would not let the city run out of water in a future drought, but they would expect the people of Santa Barbara to engage in water rationing, let their lawns and gardens wither, and adopt real estate development restrictions if a severe drought occurred. For a wealthy city, this would constitute a water crisis. A little over 25 years later, when that severe drought finally materialized, the city looked to its decommissioned desalination plant for a solution. The passage of time worked in Santa Barbara's favor. During the intervening years, advances in seawater desalination, driven by investments from other wealthy, water-stressed cities, reduced the energy needed to produce drinking water from the sea by about 40%. The desalinated seawater was still more expensive than the city's other water sources, but its reliability justified the cost. In 2017, the local utility invested over $70 million to revive and upgrade its mothballed seawater desalination plant. When it is operating, the new plant provides about a third of the city's water. During wet periods, Santa Barbara can save money by putting its desalination plant into standby mode. If an even more severe drought someday were to overwhelm the capacity of the plant to augment the city's water supply, its capacity could be expanded. Santa Barbara was able to solve its water crisis because its residents could afford desalinated seawater. They are not alone. About 300 million people worldwide, in such wealthy cities as Riyadh, Tel Aviv, and Perth, have turned to seawater desalination plants for water security. Increasingly, cities that lack access to the ocean, or where citizens are concerned about the energy consumption and environmental impacts of seawater desalination, are adopting other technologies that allow them to recycle their wastewater or to obtain their drinking water from aquifers that only a few decades ago were considered to be too salty to serve as water supplies. Because water security is not the top priority of cities until a drought occurs, wealthy cities still undergo crises before adopting these high-tech solutions. But the existence of these easily deployable approaches has reduced the damage that a city experiences. As is the case with so many other situations, wealth goes a long way toward crisis mitigation. The ability of wealthy communities to buy their way out of scarcity stands in stark contrast to the situation faced by people who can afford the infrastructure needed to store, treat, and deliver drinking water, but for whom the extra cost of technologies such as desalination is out of reach. Almost half of the world's population currently fits into this category. Because a drought typically consists of an extended period of below-normal precipitation and not a complete absence of rain, during a drought, a city faces a merciless race against time, in which it must develop new water resources and decrease the rate of water consumption before the water remaining in its reservoirs or groundwater aquifers is exhausted. If the public concludes that the city is losing the race, the result is a water crisis. Water managers have a variety of tools at their disposal for increasing the water supplies during a drought. They can purchase water rights from nearby farmers or cities that have excess capacity. When that is impractical, they can dig deeper wells or build new reservoirs. Alternatively, they can sacrifice water quality for quantity by blending groundwater or river water that would otherwise be too salty to drink into their remaining water supply. Water managers also possess the means of reducing the rate at which their city consumes water. As a drought intensifies, they can ramp up the pressure on their customers to reduce water consumption, first through voluntary cutbacks publicized by media campaigns on billboards, radio, and internet sites, and then by creating penalties for profligate water users and rewards for those who meet conservation goals. If all else fails, they can ration water by shutting off parts of the water distribution system during different times of the day. The situation confronted by Sao Paulo when a drought hit the city in 2014 is representative of this second water crisis. Despite its subtropical climate, Brazil's largest city has struggled with water provision. The main cause has been explosive population growth. The metropolitan area grew from approximately 8 million people in 1970 to more than 20 million by 2010. As a nation, Brazil tends to invest a much smaller fraction of its wealth in water infrastructure than other emerging economies. During the period when the city was rapidly expanding, its water utility extended its main water supply canal to a second watershed and built a few new reservoirs. But the extra water was not enough. Sao Paulo needed to be more aggressive in expanding its capacity to deliver water because, as its population was surging, parts of its previously built water supply were becoming unusable. As more people moved into the city, its informal settlements, or favelas, began to encroach on the watersheds where its urban reservoirs were located. Because the favelas were not connected to the city's sewers, some of the reservoirs became too polluted to use as drinking water sources. Failure of the local water utility to maintain the city's underground pipe network during this period also contributed to the problem. By the early 2000s, about a quarter of the treated water put into the city's pipes was being lost through leaks. Despite the growing mismatch between supply and demand, the city did not invest aggressively in water conservation, which is the normal practice of utilities confronting water stress. According to its critics, the water utility believed that it was in the business of selling water and had little motivation to spend money on a program that could shrink its revenues by discouraging water use. Despite the growing stress on the system, Sao Paulo's water utility continued to serve the needs of the city for many years, thanks in part to the fact that over a meter of rain fell annually in the watersheds where the city's reservoirs are located. But regional changes in precipitation patterns have diminished the reservoir's ability to capture water. The average amount of rain that fell west and north of Sao Paulo, where the reservoirs are located, actually increased slightly in the decades leading up to the drought. But more of the precipitation was arriving in short, intense summertime storms. This meant that the capacity of the city's reservoirs would have needed to be expanded if they were to capture the summer rains for use during the dry season, while simultaneously leaving enough excess capacity in the reservoirs to protect the city from flooding. Because the utility did not expand the city's reservoirs quickly enough, the system became more vulnerable to the drought of 2014. Sao Paulo's changing rainfall patterns appear to be related to two main factors. First, climate change has altered regional weather patterns, as higher ocean temperatures have increased the humidity of the offshore air and altered atmospheric circulation patterns. Second, conversion of the region's forests and farms into buildings and roads has changed the microclimate around the city through a phenomenon referred to as the urban heat island effect. In essence, the heat released by cars and air conditioners, coupled with the tendency of concrete and asphalt to absorb more of the sun's energy than the trees and crops that used to be there, has made the air above the city slightly warmer. This subtle change has led to more intense storms in the watersheds where the reservoirs are located when the moisture-laden air from the city encounters cooler conditions after passing over Sao Paulo. The discovery that cities can alter precipitation patterns at first came as a surprise to meteorologists. After all, this is the branch of science that debunked the false notion that rain would fall on the grasslands of North America's Great Plains when they were converted into farms, an idea that was popularized by the saying, "Rain follows the plow," in the 1870s. Although Great Plains farmers did not make the Great Plains suitable for rain-fed agriculture, paving over cities does have subtle effects on rainfall patterns. In Sao Paulo, as well as a host of other rapidly expanding cities, such as Atlanta and Dallas, it turns out that rain follows the bulldozer. Like many middle-income cities struggling with drought, water supply was not the only issue concerning Sao Paulo's politicians and members of the public. When the drought hit, Brazil was facing a severe recession, a political scandal, and an outbreak of an insect-borne disease, Zika virus, just as it was preparing to host the Summer Olympics in facilities that might not be ready when the crowds arrived. The simultaneous occurrence of multiple political and social challenges may have prevented a stronger response from the distracted federal government. When the level of water in the city's main reservoir fell below the system's intake pipe, and the press showed up to take dramatic photographs and write about the upcoming water apocalypse, the government's response was muted. The severity of the water crisis in the eyes of the public was intensified when the utility announced that it would be installing pumps to access the part of the reservoir that engineers commonly call the dead storage. Despite the alarming tone of the media coverage, utility leaders knew that the situation was not as dire as it seemed. In fact, the extra attention worked to their advantage because recognition by the public that their water supply was in danger meant that the utility could start spending money on its response without fear of a public relations backlash when consumers received higher water bills. Over a period of about 12 months, Sao Paulo built more than 10 kilometers of pipelines, connecting parts of the city to reservoirs that still had adequate capacity. This internal water transfer allowed the utility to reduce the daily demand on the city's stressed main reservoir by about 20%. With the public's attention focused on water shortage, the city turned its attention to water conservation. By offering consumers bonuses for saving water and penalties for exceeding their allocation, the utility drove down water demand by about 10%. Finally, the utility lowered the water pressure in the pipe network to reduce the amount of water that escaped through cracks in the underground pipes and repaired some of the city's worst leaks, which cut water use by an additional 20%. Within a year, Sao Paulo's water demand was more closely balanced with its decreased supply. During the drought, the utility also gained approval for more than $1 billion in new water projects to expand its water supply to reduce future risks of shortage. If the drought had continued for another year or two, the city might have faced some difficult decisions about who would have to go without water. The federal politicians might have even stepped up to help. The water crisis had moved onto the front page of the newspapers, but the city was not going to run out of water. Although predictions that Sao Paulo was about to descend into chaos may have been exaggerated, the drought greatly inconvenienced the public, it also had economic consequences that will be felt for many years. During the drought, reduced water pressure was a major problem for people living in the hills surrounding the city, because water did not reach the higher elevation.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?